Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And if you're going to start your own prayer circle for reclaiming the Republic or for, you know, taking our country back and, you know, waking people up, that type of thing, then let me know. We'll put you up there, but you're more than welcome to join the Loudoun County Prayer Circle because we just want to, solicit the appeal to heaven. John Locke basically stated that we have this right and responsibility to appeal to heaven when we're dealing with tyranny. So, and, you know, I've been kind of talking about this, folks, on my radio show about, you know, on Friday, about uniting and so forth. I'll get into that even more this coming Friday. But one of the things we kind of left you with in the conversation yesterday is that the Tory acts were the people exercising their rights under common law to, one, assemble, organize, and be able to petition government for a redress of grievances. Now, technically, when we look at this current... Oh, welcome back, Tammy. I mean, I'm talking to you, but people don't know who I'm talking to. So welcome back. And I don't think the people were cued into this, but folks, we kind of had a follow-on conversation after going through what we went through in the Tory Acts. And so what we want to do, or what I'd like to do, maybe not Tammy want to do, but I think it's really important to start understanding our legal system. So folks, when you boil down the legal system of the land, it's kind of declared by the type of law system you're going to implement. Now, when we created our government, we instituted our government in America, we instituted very specific roles and responsibilities to that federal government. And we clearly, it was identified by George Mason, and it was even supported by Madison, that the Constitution did not declare common law. What it did do was, in the Bill of Rights, it preserved the right of common law and those fundamental rights under common law that you have a right to a trial by jury. See, in common law, there are very specific things that you're granted these rights. Now, common law in Britain, they created these rights under the Bill of Rights. And it was actually initiated under the Magna Carta shortly after they tried to implement common law under the Roman civil law system. Now, folks, common law is a legal system for the people to seek justice. Now, we have criminal justice and we have civil justice, right? If your neighbor encroaches upon your yard or somebody does damage, maybe it wasn't a crime, it was an accident or what have you, common law is the court where you would pursue justice. Now, does that make sense, Tammy?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a legal system of how that's to be done. And so common law in Britain was basically guided by the Bible. So the Bible was the supreme law of the land. Now, in America, we shifted that. And so we shifted the common law, or I should say the supreme law of the land, is the U.S. Constitution, where now, because the problem was that we had multiple versions of the Bible and multiple versions of Christianity in the United States. We had 13 states, and each of them had their own church. In other words, each state was basically a theocratic, I'll just say Republican form of government. We didn't have a king, they didn't have despots, or I should say, you know, tyrants or aristocracies or oligarchies. It was really a representative government of the people in the very initial setup. In other words, looking at the Tory Acts, now I just want to examine the Tory Acts in detail. under the rights of the Magna Carta as Englishmen, the colonists had this right to create their own representative organization. They had the right to organize and then speak as a bodied people to petition the king and or parliament. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that right to do that was protected by both the Magna Carta and the Glorious Bill of Rights. So when all of a sudden you're being oppressed by the government in Britain under the common law of England and under the monarchical theocracy, they had this right of organizing. Now, in common law, this right of assembly, these fundamental rights are kind of preserved. And in the Constitution guarantees to all U.S. citizens the right of assembly and the right of petitioning government for the redress of grievances. Now, do you need to create an organization? So, because what they had to do was they actually had to create representatives for themselves. And so each colony kind of broke down into communities or, you know, large communities where they created their own representation and they called them either assemblies, conventions, councils, or committees of safety. So that's how they organized, because at that point in time, did they have a representative government? No, they were a monarchical government. The question is, under this Constitution and under the framework of our government, where we have a representative at the federal level, we have a representative at the state level, and we have a representative at the county level, do we need to organize representatives?
I would say no.
No, we don't. So under common law, under the framework of our government, we already have a representative. We already have that Republican form that was guaranteed under the Magna Carta to organize and create a representative body to petition the king. And the reason they wanted to do this and the reason they had this right to do this was to help increase the magnitude of the voice of the petition. In other words, as the people assembled and organized, they spoke for the people. That's what your county commissioners do. They speak for the people of the county. That's what your state legislature does. They speak for the people of the state out of the House of Representatives. That's what they do. That's their job, is to represent you and give you your suffrage when it comes to the federal government. And the same thing, your representative at the federal government is to give you suffrage at that level as well. In other words, your representative is to represent and basically, and I dove into this actually on Monday, but when we look at having 1 million people or 750,000 people, how well are you really being represented? This is one of the reasons why the Constitution locked down representation to be 30,000. They can't, they have no authority to go beyond 30,000. They took it upon themselves to say, we can't represent you at that numbers realistically because we only have so many seats, so we got to change it. No. If they got to change it, then they got to amend the Constitution. And I'm telling you, had they had to come to us to basically say, hey, we need to be able to arbitrarily control this, I think people would have woke up real quick and said, hold on here. What does that mean? Does that mean that they can actually, you know, put us into a large body of representation? where we have to fight for representation. Where we right now, what we're doing is you have one representative for Wyoming, and you guys are overrepresented compared to the rest of the nation. And what I mean by that is you only have 500,000 people competing to talk and get Harriet Hageman to basically represent you. The rest of the union has 700,000 plus, almost 800,000 people fighting to get their representation out of that one body. Now, I'm going to go back to the Constitutional Convention. The very last day, George Washington felt it was wrong that 40,000 people be represented by one person. He felt that they couldn't fairly be represented by one person. He thought that that number was too much. He felt that it needed to be reduced down to, at best, 30,000, if not less. And so he suggested it be reduced to 30,000. And it was seconded, or actually it was moved and then seconded by the body of the convention. And they so changed the Constitution to where that became 30,000 people, where it was locked into the Constitution that it could not go, one representative could not exceed representing 30,000. Now, they didn't really define what that means. And I think we talked about this in the Constitutional, during the Constitution month and a half or two, when we were going through the Constitution, we dove into this. And I don't believe that they really nailed down what does that 30,000 mean, 30,000 persons? But it did include representation, because when it came to apportionment, a slave would be 3/5. Now, a slave is typically an adult, right? You don't count the children. So is that 30,000 adults or what have you? And I think when you really look at the initial numbers, I think that's what it was those people who could cognitively, you know, create an argument to a representative to say, hey, you know, this is a problem. You got to address this. Because a child shouldn't have access to basically, you know, petition adults and say, hey, you got to address this. Because at that point in time, they're children. Yeah, they're children. they have children's minds, and they have parents that are supposed to protect them and represent them. So here's the problem. This needs to be definitively laid out by the states. The states literally need to come to the federal government and say, you know what, that 30,000, that representation, that apportionment that we're referring to, that should be based on either U.S. citizens that are of the voter's age, and I think that's what it should be, and that's it. In other words, you don't count illegals. They can't be apportioned. Because the state of California is being rewarded for having illegals counted in that. And so they have extra representation, right? So does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah.
So I think the states literally need to state this. And as a matter of fact, the 14th Amendment, Section 2, helps lend to this, because Section 2 of the 14th Amendment states that if a state doesn't allow a person to vote and they're considered eligible to vote under the U.S. Constitution, in other words, today, back in then, it was 21 years of age for the 14th Amendment and it had to be a male. In the old days, some states created it had to be a white male or what have you. With the 14th Amendment and then the 15th Amendment, it basically says a black male, 21 years of age, had the right to vote. But they also had poll taxes, and everybody had a poll tax. They started going after poll taxes when states started creating an additional shenanigan to where it wasn't considered a property tax. And as a matter of fact, if you didn't own property, which a lot of blacks didn't own, so they couldn't vote. They were trying to basically make laws so they could. So technically, they were violating the Section 2 of the 14th Amendment and so forth. There was ways to fix this, but I just, getting back to the point that the states need to delineate precisely what that representation means. And I believe it should mean a body of U.S. citizen adults, in other words, 18 years of age, whatever, and actually it should be 17 years of age, because technically by law, Congress has basically made the service of if somebody joining the militia to be 17. In other words, they set the standard for the states that a person can join the militia and participate in the militia at age 17. Does that mean that the voter age needs to change? No. It just means that you become an adult. Remember that in the 1950s and the 60s, you had to be 21 years of age. Even though you were considered an adult in, you know, the eyes of the law of the state, you still couldn't vote, because the Constitution, at least in federal elections, you had to be 21 years of age. States could have actually changed that. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you a good example. Wyoming allowed women to vote, even though the federal government didn't allow women to vote, and only Wyoming. So Wyoming used their own laws to basically give women suffrage, which there's nothing wrong with that. They didn't need to have an amendment. And I don't think anywhere in the Constitution's language, in the 15th Amendment, it stated men. You know what? Let's go to, because when we start talking, I hate talking sideways, right? So the 15th Amendment did not say race or sex, I should say. The 14th Amendment, did it say male in the 14th? Yes, it did. So the 14th Amendment, Section 2, basically, but you got to remember, Section 2 of the 14th Amendment was a negative. In other words, if the state denied a male, black male, as a U.S. citizen, their ability to vote, it wasn't that they couldn't do it, that they would lose that count of that person for apportionment. So if they had a law that said you can't vote, you know, any black male citizen, and they don't have the age in here, yeah, 21 years of age, any, so that's what it says, being 21 years of age and citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged except for participation in rebellion or other crime. In other words, you could take the rights of voting away from people that are rebelling. I want you to understand this. The 14th Amendment, Section 2, basically says if you're rebelling against the Constitution, you can take away their right to vote and their citizenship. That's what it says here. Or other crime, the basis of representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens 21 years of age in the such state. So they were talking about apportionment here with 21 years of age males. And so most people just thought that the age of voting was 21 years of age, but it was never cast in stone. So until the 25th Amendment, the 26th Amendment. It was the 26th Amendment that allowed males of 18 years of age. And at that point in time, it was an 18-year-old. You had to be 18 years old to go serve. And they said, hey, if that person go die for the country, they should be able to vote. And so I think we need to revisit that. And I'd like to actually see, you know, the service go up to 19 or something like that so that nobody can be pulled out of high school, that there's no way you can use going into the military or into the militia of service at, you know, at 18 years of age, at 18, regardless of when that is. You have to be 19, which by all rules, there'd be a very small exception, and maybe the language should say 19 years of age or at least graduated from high school, something like that. But bottom line, this concept, because we're talking about common law, this concept of common law and a legal system and the right of being, you know, represented for justice, because that's what we're going down this path for. Where do we get and who has the right to justice? So you have to be an adult. You have to be a citizen of the United States. And under common law, you should be able to seek compensation. But when we go into the instituting of our government, the federal government was constrained, the courts are constrained to only those things that arise under this Constitution. Now, the state courts didn't have that kind of language, but clearly when we created a state government to serve the counties, we actually created a government and laid out what its powers and its boundaries were. The thing they did in state is all things not delegated or reserved, but clearly it was an enumerated constitution that enumerated very specific powers. Did it grant the state government general powers of courts and common law and a legal system? And it didn't. What it did do, see, what every state, when they joined the union, they declared, and they didn't even declare common law in the state constitution. I don't believe if you open up the Wyoming Constitution, I could be wrong, but I do not believe you will find the words common law being declared for the state of Wyoming. They did that in while it was a territory, the common law would be the law of the state. And at that point, they didn't have a government. So when they created the state government that was operating, you know, at that point in time, concurrently under the federal jurisdiction, federal control, and it became a state, they delegated very specific powers in that state constitution of what that state government would do. If it didn't give it jurisdiction over common law, then where is your common law to be? It's to be down at your county. But if you haven't dictated a constitution, then you really created a mess, because who owns that court? It should be the people's court. Mm-hmm. And who should fund that? Well, the funding of that should be baked into the whatever the taxes are. And so are the taxes going into the county? The county should actually have the funding necessary to provide a common law court for the people. Civil law and common law are two legal systems that provide justice for the people so that all people have access to justice. However, you don't go to your government for justice over things that you've not delegated to your government. If all of a sudden, because of irreconcilable differences, a husband and a wife cannot be separated, or cannot maintain a marriage, I mean, and they want to get separated and get divorced, do you go to the state to get divorced? Well, no, they don't have any jurisdiction over marriage or divorce. Unless your constitution, you've delegated those powers. That they were the ones to create, because in the old days, where did you get divorced or where did you get married? Well, actually, at a church. And so it was under the union and auspices of a priesthood or some hierarchical authority that, you know, is established in the church.
So what did they do?
So did they have divorces back in those days?
Yes, they just didn't, right?
They didn't. What ended up happening was, because they didn't have divorces, men would abandon, or women in some cases, the person that just wanted out just abandoned the family. In some cases, people wanted to, you know, go, and the Catholic Church was the one that basically said you can't have a divorce. But Catholic Church was the one that did that for their church, and other churches kind of followed that suit. That once you get married, and so
which is a mess, because people just separate and then live with somebody else.
Right. Well, that's a fiasco. But in some cases, it has forced people to reconcile their differences. And so is society. I don't mean to get philosophical, but, you know, this is something that we have to decide. Are we better off? Are our children and our future generations better off enforcing two people that have a hard time getting along to, you know, maintain an abode, a family, and, you know, an environment for their children, which could be hostile? But nine times out of ten, I honestly think that the numbers would probably bear that it's better to stay married. I understand that there's probably maybe a 30%, I don't know what the numbers would be, but out of the people that are having a hard time, failing to reconcile. The problem is, today, when we look at divorces occur because there's, you know, it's too easy to just walk away. We've made divorce easy. In the old days, when it was difficult to get divorced, you know, there were people that just didn't do it because it was difficult, and so forth. Where as the easier it got, the more of a tragedy that it weighed on society. Now, I believe that we should have a society that makes it very difficult. But if you need to, the process can happen, and it can cleanly happen. But bottom line, where does that justice come? Now, that justice comes in a common law court, which is one of the reasons why the Seventh Amendment states this, because it's in suits. So when you talk about a suit, and in cases of a controversy where money or the value of money is there, in suits at common law, which would a breaking up of a marriage would be in the suit of common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. In other words, this concept, we're going into a break here, this concept of having a trial by jury for a divorce has been completely taken away from us, folks. In other words, the Seventh Amendment actually guarantees that if you're going to have a controversy, if your divorce is attuned to anything greater than $20, you have a right to a trial by jury. instead of allowing a judge and a social system to literally dictate, you know, and punish one gender over another and so forth. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so when we look at common law, if it's not delegated to the federal government, when we talk about divorce and those types of things, we actually have a right. And so I think this is one of the things government, does the state want to actually pay for two court systems? Of course not. I don't think so. And so, you know, but we have a right to have justice, and we've actually contained our state government into a framework that keeps them contained into those matters. In other words, folks, we got to look at creating government as creating powers of attorney, limited and specified powers of attorney. This is what you've delegated to them. That's all they can do. If it's not specified, they can't assume that they can do it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when we look at common law and how things are going today, going and looking at the Tory Acts, because this is all framed on the Tory Acts, what would common law be if we actually had a problem? What would be the common law process? Now, I really skipped over some stuff, because bottom line, when you look at common law and you look at what the Tory Acts were doing, the people were actually speaking definitively of how their rights were being, you know, they were calling out the king a petition that their rights were being violated. And clearly, there's nothing that the king could do to say that they weren't Englishmen. They were Englishmen. They were born under and they were living under the jurisdiction of the crown. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so as Englishmen, they had these very specific rights. And so the king couldn't play, you know, with granting their rights as Englishmen to these people in this colony, because if that happened, because right now the way they were playing the game, the only people that were granted the privileges of being Englishmen were those people who were living properly in Britain. Therefore, if they afforded it to one colony, they would have had to afford it to all colonies. And then that would basically, if we look today, it's the same issue that we have today with representation. If we have 30,000 people, so I'm going to pull up a calculator if I can find one. I thought I had one. And I don't, so I'll just go to my programs and pull up a calculator real quick. There's a calculator right there. Okay, so if we have, I think you can see that now, right? So if we have, let's just say there's 300, I think the census has us around 330 million. And so if we know that there were...
For the entire United States.
The entire United States, correct. And if we know that the entire United States has, in 2018, there were at least 20 million illegals, and we know between 2018 and 2021, there were probably another couple million that came in. So let's just say that was 22, 24 million, 24 million, and it has been accounted in a survey now that under the Biden administration, about another 10 million came in. So let's just say that that's about, I'll round it up to 35 million. I think it's more like 40 million to 50 million, but I'll just round it up to 35 million. So what that would do is we'd take 35 million invaders off of the census. That would take us to 285, right? Or no, 295. Mm-hmm. 295, that would be million. Oops, I keep on 85. 295, why is that coming up with 80? I'll do it this way. You seeing that?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me go to this so it's not so big, and I'll just blow it up this way.
Interesting. 9,833 representatives.
Based on 30,000, that is correct. So now you just did the math for me, because that's what I'm trying to do. How much would that be? That would be 9,000 representatives that would have to sit where? In Parliament, if this was Britain. But it's not Britain, it's Congress. So this would be 9,000 people that would have to sit in D.C. Now, if we actually amend the Constitution with the very first right, or the very first amendment in the Bill of Rights, that would give us 50,000, right? So if we do 29,500,000, and we divide that actually with an extra zero. So there's the 295 million, and we divide that by 50,000, and that would cut it down to just under 6,000 representatives. A little bit better, right? It's a smaller number. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, the question is, why would we need to water it down to 50,000 if we could actually live with 10,000? Now, everybody's scratching their heads. How can we live with 10,000 people trying to fit into that small chamber of the House of Representatives? Well, we live in a time, and I mentioned this on Monday, we live in a time where we have the ability, technology-wise, to extend our representation of the Senate back to the state legislatures. So if you had the chance to listen to my show, which I know you're one of my number one fans, that on Monday, you probably didn't hear it though, but on Monday, I basically stated that the states could actually not only rescind the 17th Amendment, because Biden opened that door, but the states could actually, and if Trump actually became the advocate of dismantling the Senate as we know it today, and actually purify the intent behind the Senate. So the reason we created a bicameral legislative body was that one house would offer suffrage for the states in that house. In other words, the Senate gives the state suffrage to basically oversee and have their hand in who the justices of the Supreme Court would be. Who, you know, the ratification, the states would actually have their hand in determining whether that treaty would be ratified or not, and they'd be able to challenge whether it is constitutional or not. That's what the Senate's supposed to do. And the same thing with cabinet members and so forth. So in other words, the question is, do we actually need senators sitting in D.C. having autonomy, not even representing the state legislature anymore? They're representing those people who bought those seats, the globalists, with billions of dollars. What? How well would our republic be served if they actually dismantled the representation? Now, I've already thrown this out there just so, you know, try to cut to the chase. We wouldn't get rid of having a person in D.C. That person would then be a proxy. It would be one person, and that person would then be able to vote if necessary, if the state, some calamity hit the state and the state legislature could not provide its direction or its vote on how it would vote for a given treaty. And the call for a vote needed to be done, and therefore, boom, they needed to do that. And because I'm telling you, with technology today, they could quickly, you know, electronically get together. They could do this faster than the way the Senate even works today. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so why
hopefully would it be a better system than Zoom?
Absolutely, because now the globalists would actually have to buy every seat in every state legislature. Do you understand what I just said? Yeah. How many seats would that be? So right now we're looking at, as far as seats go, in the state legislatures across the United States, and in contrast to the Senate, there's 100 seats right now in the Senate, correct? Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the total Senate numbers, and let me just add this up because I've got it right here, and I can actually add all of the Senate seats, and I think this will do it, or I should say state legislature seats. That's 1,922 across the states, and that would be, as far as the Senate in the states, that would be 5,400. So I total all of the state legislature seats, and we're talking about 7,326 instead of 100. How much money would the globalist have to spend? And oh, by the way, folks, when we start really thinking about improving our representation, in other words, now that we have our representatives, because we just talked about this, we talked about having representatives that would be almost 7,000 or 10,000, right? Where are they going to be working from? They don't need to be on the floor to vote. They don't need to be in that house to vote. They can have their debates and everything else via networking, via Zoom calls and so forth, by breaking it down into the different dialogues to where, you know, they would have each body being represented out of maybe the state house, where the state legislature would basically have all of your representatives when they have to make votes on bills and so forth. They could go in because, you know, we'd probably have
a good idea.
You see my point. We'd have probably hundreds, maybe in California and New York, but in many of the other states, it would be, you know, maybe 40 or 50, right? And so there's a way to do this to improve, because our government serves us better when they're doing better work for us. And when they actually can be held accountable by us, then we can actually keep them constrained. And when we actually, you know, keep them constrained, we actually preserve our liberty. If we're abiding by the system that we have, our government would be amazingly efficient. And we wouldn't need to have all of these representatives and all of this would basically, I wouldn't say depopulate, but the need for all these things, because why would we have so many corporate offices in D.C. anymore? The only reason all those corporate offices of the world are sitting there, they buy rent and they rent these buildings and build buildings around the D.C. area so that they can do lobbying to walk right into your representatives and your senators' offices to say, we're going to give you some campaign money and we want you to do this and vote this way. This is how it works. Mm-hmm. And it's all insidious and it's all unconstitutional. In other words, those are your representatives, and they're actually representing people they have no business representing.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, folks, I'm just telling you, understanding our Republican form of government and the reason we have the sovereignty is helps you understand this concept and the struggle that we have in tying common law. So getting back to common law, because that's what got us down these paths, we actually have, and we have this requirement to actually have a separate court system. But the reason why they created this representative body was that the representative body could do things. Now, when you actually have a crime, an infamous crime, does the representatives have the ability to create the indictment? No. Even under the Constitution, there needs to be a body jury, which we call a grand jury, that has to provide an indictment whether that person should stand trial for a crime. It's the same thing when it comes to petitioning our government. Our county commissioners are our representatives, but they shouldn't be the ones that actually work in a vacuum. Remember, we're supposed to have, in the common law system and in this constitutional system, we're supposed to be a self-governing body. We're supposed to be involved in our government. So this is why your county commissioners need to create this committee under common law, where these people who are now chosen, this is all created under the auspices of common law by your county, by your representative government, and they can actually create this jury or committee, synonymous, the same, other than this hasn't anything to do with a criminal crime, but they can organize these people, citizens of your county, and actually start creating outcomes to guide them on whether, you know, what is the legitimate constitution? What's being done that's constitutional? What's being done that isn't constitutional? In other words, the guidance can come from the people to actually tell them definitively, you need to stand up against anything that's coming out of D.C., out of that constitution called the annotated constitution. We need to stop redefining it. This is the only legitimate constitution you can use. I know I'm fire hosing, and I know that this is a little bit complex, but it's really not. Once you've got your arms around this, once you realize that we're using the Constitution as our weapon, because the Constitution has only very specific enumerations. They can only mess with these things. So we can use the Constitution to say, if these things don't exist in the Constitution, then we can wipe them out. This is how everything that they're spending money on that is not an enumerated object in that Constitution, that money being spent is fraud. The government that is being, and the rules and regulations that are being applied to you is fraudulent laws and rules. There's another word for it. It's called the color of law. Color of law are fraudulent laws. So understanding that when government started stepping on the rights of the citizens back in those days, they understood, because it was a simple theocratic monarchical republic. In other words, the people had representation in parliament at that point in time. And even though it may be a token gesture of representation, the people still had a right to, you know, oppose and actually petition for redress of grievances to parliament and the king, their rights to basically make sure that they have representation when they're being taxed, and that they have these fundamental rights that you can't quarter these things. You can't quarter armed forces into our homes. You can't displace us. You can't, you know, we have rights under the glorious Bill of Rights that you can't do these things to us. That's what they were doing. They were actually standing up on the law that Britain, the Kingdom of Britain, was to be functioning under, and saying, you're violating our rights and the law. At this point in time in our lives, folks, the only reason we're not doing this is, one, because there's way too many people that have confused the issues. There have been people, jurists, lawyers, historians, and so forth, that have maintained the fallacy that we're still under the monarchical theocracy, that the Bible is the supreme law of the land. That was wiped out by the Constitution. Now, the states were able to maintain that until they actually went to a secular. When they stood down the church, the state church, and said, we're no longer having a symbiotic relationship, then the governing law was based on the Constitution and the state Constitution. Didn't mean you were being thrown into the fire. It didn't mean that you're granting them unvarnished rights, where they just could do anything. They didn't have general powers. They still had enumerated powers, and they can only govern you based on those powers granted. So even though it sounds good, and I know most patriots, they hear, you have the rights, you know, guaranteed by the Bible. Well, no, you actually have rights even more protected by the Constitution, because the Bible, under the years of, you know, theocracies, the Bible can easily be perverted to basically say we can start stoning people, you know, we can burn people or what have you, because they're committing sins, and they can interpret it the way they want. However, the Constitution literally protects you to say government cannot abridge anything. And as a matter of fact, the Ninth Amendment is even more powerful than any power of what the Bible provides today, because the Ninth Amendment lays out this, you know, this context that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, if the government has the right of, you know, eminent domain, it doesn't mean that they have the right to actually take away your property without compensation, without just compensation. And the key to that is just compensation. Even though they may have the right to take that away, there is still needs to be this. And actually, this is where government actually says, hey, there's no way we can justly compensate taking this land from these people. Why? Because the cost would be too great. Because technically, it's not about what the going rate is for a square mile of land or an acre or square footage of land in the city. There are intrinsic values. There are things that you can create. And bottom line, when you look at the Ninth Amendment in context to eminent domain, going up to the Seventh Amendment, if you're going to receive just compensation, the Seventh Amendment, because this is common law, in suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. So in other words, they have a legal responsibility if they're invoking eminent domain and to take your property or to do any damage to your property because they want to run a pipeline on it, which would exceed $20 value, then you have a right to stand in front of a jury to seek your just compensation.
Wouldn't that apply to, if we can't pay our taxes and they want to take our house, wouldn't that apply to that too? Shouldn't we receive just compensation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What should happen if you can't pay taxes, and if this is repugnant, the whole point, even though this is not edged into our law, as Madison stated in the Federalist Paper 10, and this is where I'll use theory in the design of our laws and the design of this nation, the theory or the purpose of we the people instituting government is to protect life. In other words, they're supposed to make sure that we're not under the threat of losing our lives by hostile, you know, forces external to us or enemies within, insurgents and so forth. So they're to protect our lives. That's why we created governments, to protect us and to protect our private property so that people can't take it from us. So invaders can't come and take our land. Or the government can't take our land either. They're supposed to be protecting it. So the fact that we even have, the reason they had property tax in the very beginning was only to vote. Property tax was a toll that
it was voluntary.
It was voluntary. If you didn't want to participate in government, you didn't pay the property tax. And they couldn't take your land. There was never a way they could create an arrears to where, oh, this, you know, you owe us more than the value of your property. But again, if even though they've gone down this path and they've created this problem and you're in that situation, they still can't take that land away from you without just compensation. So in other words, let's say your tax bill is $20,000, but your house and your property is worth $500,000. Okay, so now they say, okay, we're going to take your land because you're not paying us. Or what they can do is they can put a lien on that land. That's what they probably should do until the lien on that land exceeds the value of the land. However, the real question comes into this, just compensation. There's the value that is apprised by, you know, the real estate folks that say, well, this is the common value of that. It doesn't assign the intrinsic value that must be respected under common law. Just compensation is, hey, we've got a family burial plot here. You know, we've got, you know, these intrinsic values. Let's say you have a view of, you know, the mountain range or what have you, where nobody else has that. That you can't place a value on that Zillow would appreciate. This is why the whole value must be brought before a jury and allow the jury to determine what that value is, not a real estate institution. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so the sacredness of the voice of the people to determine justice is embedded in our Constitution under these concepts of both common law and the Constitution itself. This sacredness was actually preserved by that Seventh Amendment to ensure that no citizen could not be able to receive justice even over a trifling $20, that the people had a right to make their appeal to their citizens of the vicinage. Now, one of the things of a trial by jury, here's something interesting. A trial by jury of your peers is a jury that actually has the ability to correctly judge the issue. Now, I'll give you a good case in point, because we live in a very technical world today, to where you could be dealing with somebody that is pursuing, you know, intellectual property rights over some really technical issues. A jury of your peers would not just be people of the local community. You'd probably have to go much further out to actually bring people in who understand the issues. In other words, they're peers of the issue. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They, in other words, they have to be, you know, they have to understand if it's a medical issue, a biological issue, you know, they need to bring in a jury of people that understand that issue in as local of an area as possible. You may have to go throughout the state to bring in jurors over some medical justice system or over some high tech system, quantum physics, rocket science. You know, you can't just have, I'll just say, because it's not fair, it's not justice if the people don't even understand the technical issues at hand. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Because the whole point is to deliver a full level of justice to satisfy the need of justice for the individual as well as the case that that person's bringing forward. And if it's that level of complexity, a common law court needs to actually go down that path of seeking that. But here's the thing. Common law does not provide punitive damage. In other words, if you're burnt and you're hurt, common law will compensate you for those losses, but not punitive. Civil law provides punitive. So there are some nuances that, you know, people need to kind of understand, because common law wasn't, you know, a mechanism of going out and hurting people. It was a mechanism of justice, that justice was being served. So regardless of, you know, how hot the coffee was that burnt Granny's lap, the fact that McDonald's was hit with this punitive, you know, even though they had these policies, that shouldn't have happened. Now, here's the problem, that McDonald's was and has become a global corporation. Under the Constitution, there's no such thing in America as global corporations. Corporations are established within the state and they operate within the state. The state cannot allow a corporation, you know, to, you know, and regulate it outside of its state. So it has full sovereignty over that corporation. So in other words, if Walmart is going to operate around, across the Republic, and we've just ran out of time. So if you can keep that thought, we will bring that up tomorrow on what we do with Walmart before we get back into the Tory Act. But I just wanted to help everybody understand. Well, I'll tie it all together tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.